Great. Okay. So today's the 18th of January. I'm Mark Hansen. And I wanted to talk with you and really open it up as well for a consideration of bringing morality, which is what we talked about last time, or virtue probably is a better word for it, to oneself, particularly with regard to our tendency to harm ourselves. The essence of virtue, sometimes called sila in Buddhism, is non-harming. If you know the Eightfold Path, it has eight elements in it, and the second of the eight, in terms of the traditional sequence, is right or wise intention. And the three elements of right intention are non-harming, non-ill will, and renunciation. Renunciation not in the sense necessarily of becoming a monastic and going off to some cave somewhere, but renunciation as a fundamental attitude of non-aversion and non-grasping, in particular toward the contents of mind. Okay? So it's interesting that in terms of wise intention, two of three have to do with not hurting, not with ill will and not with harming. And we usually think about that as it's applied to other people. Don't take the life of another, don't steal another's belongings, don't speak to others in ways that are harsh, and so forth. But it's very interesting to reflect on this as it's applied to ourselves. And Bill encouraged me last week to talk about this in terms of not beating up ourselves and not being mean or harsh to ourselves. And could I talk about that? So I'd like to explore this tonight. And to begin with, I'd like to quote here from the Dhamma. I think this is in the Dhammapada. It's the quote here from the Buddha is, "Mind precedes all things. Mind is their chief. Mind is their maker. If one speaks or does a deed with a mind that is pure within, happiness then follows along like a never departing shadow." If one speaks or does a deed with a mind that is pure within, happiness then follows along like a never departing shadow. That's sweet, isn't it? So, in terms of the territory of self-criticism, or what in psychoanalysis might be known as, superego introjects, the inner critic, the inner pusher, the inner stick at the back, the nattering voice of parent figures, coaches, religious teachers, big sisters, big brothers, ex-husbands, ex-wives, bosses, all the rest of that, what have you. What are we going to do about that? And so, a couple of points. First, I'd like to use the frame of right or wise speech with regard to inner speech, the thoughts we have in general, in which often we're kind of implicated, and also the thoughts that we specifically direct at ourselves. So you may know that there's six criteria for right speech in Buddhism. Five are mandatory, one's optional. So think about, just for a moment here, how you are with yourself with regard to thought, especially thought directed at yourself, that evaluates your performance, that tells you what you should do, that comments on how you're doing, that brings even, not so much with explicit content, but a kind of emotional energy of, let's say, scolding or shaming or diminishing and so forth. So the first criterion, the first requirement, is that it is well-intended. Consider how much thought is actually not well-intended, including snappish, self-critical thought directed at ourselves. Second criterion is it true? And it's interesting how often, almost as a kind of matter of justice, really, we say things to ourselves about ourselves that either exaggerate the negative or understate the positive. We have a day of work. We, for example, get a lot done. Maybe something didn't go so well. That's very often what the inner voice will fasten on and inflate and play up. And the things that went well, the things where we acted with good intention, we had a good heart, we acted skillfully, we made effort, we had grit, we had good character values, what have you, the mind just kind of blows right by. So right there, is the inner speech accurate? Is it true? Is it proportionate? Third criterion is it helpful? Is it beneficial? Will it produce a good result? Good, pragmatically defined as that which leads to happiness and welfare for ourselves and others. Will this little inner diatribe about myself make me happier or sadder? Make me more effective or less effective in life? Is it beneficial? Fourth criterion, is it timely? Right? Is it helpful? I think how often we beat ourselves up over things that you can't do anything about, or the issue happened long, long ago, right? Or it's way past the point of any available learning. Timely. And then fifth, the one where there's a lot of action, is it harsh? Or sweet, soft, rounded, civil? I think sometimes about the voice in the head, it has a harshness to it that if it were played out loud and someone outside me said it to me, I'd really bristle, right? Or if I heard someone using that tone to my kids or friends or just about anybody, yeah, it would be a problem. But we routinely use that kind of tone to ourselves. What's the tone of the inner voice or the inner voices? And then last, the optional criterion, but desirable, is the speech wanted? Right? And again, right there, how often do we really want to hear that yammering voice in the back of the head? Right? Kind of the classic response is to go, thank you for sharing. Anything else? Or, I heard that. Anything new? Or, heard that too. How about you be quiet now? You know, is it wanted? Okay, so any comment or discussion right there in terms of, what our inner speech is toward ourselves in terms of these criteria? Yeah. Yeah, I think that's a very good point. So what you're referring to, what she's referring to, is the fact, as you may have heard me say, that scientists consider that the brain has largely a negativity bias. That's because as we evolved, it was usually more urgent to pay attention to sticks than to go get carrots. So there are a lot of ways in which, especially in terms of emotional memory, we're quite vulnerable to the impact of the negative. The impact sticks. 10 things, let's say, happen in a day in a relationship. 5 are mildly positive, 4 are neutral, 1's mildly negative. What's the one we tend to think about or dwell upon or ruminate about at the end of the day? It's the one that was negative. So most of that, science, as it were, is about external events because they're easier to measure, right? But I think what you're getting at, incredibly helpfully, is to really appreciate the vulnerability of the emotional memory systems of the brain to inner negative events, which in effect implies that Mother Nature has tilted the playing field toward passing on gene copies by having us be very reactive to negatives, including the self-directed negatives. So to level the playing field for quality of life, health, and longevity, because that was that negativity wears on all three of those, quality of life, health, and longevity. To level the playing field, we have to tilt toward ourselves by really focusing on the positive and being quite careful about the negative because of this vulnerability. That doesn't mean not seeing the negative. The Buddha, interestingly, put a lot of emphasis on the willingness to be, in the traditional word, admonished. an openness to negative feedback. But when it's received, they move on, you know? And again, they model externally how we ought to be internally. Heed the lesson, get the call, have appropriate remorse that's in proportion, if any remorse is called for at all, to what happened, and then take the correction on board and move on head high. That's the external practice in the monastic community among the nuns and the monks. And what a wonderful practice to take internally. Yeah, please.
My husband used to have a phrase for business saying, one aw shit canceled out 100 attaboys. That has stuck with me a long time. Something I've just been working on recently is the idea, because I get stuck in the aw shit and then how do you get out of it?
Yeah. Right. Well, that's great. Thank you. And I think that really speaks to impermanence, the recognition of impermanence and being in the present. Yeah. Great. Thanks. Yeah. And then Lee. Yeah. Right there.
It's taken me a long time to realize that I have, even have these negative voices going on. I know I do. And most of the things that people say to me is if you're hard on yourself, people will always say that. And until people used to start telling me that, I didn't even know I was doing it. So the awareness of it is really important for me. Before I can even say it.
Yeah. Thank you. And you're reminding me of as Linda knows, the phrase somatic marker, the body sense of that critical self-criticism. And I think about the actual word you use there, which is the traditional phrase, being hard on oneself. And I know for myself, when I'm in that self-critical mode, it does feel tense, contracted. There's a body sense, and there's a sense of something's pushing hard, almost metallic, grinding, hard. Just feel that, right? So it's helpful sometimes to be aware of kind of what it feels like in the body when we're tipping into this way of being where we're not being kind to ourselves and instead we're being hard on ourselves. Because that's often the clue. We can catch the body sensation sometimes sooner than we can catch the mind stream going by. All right, great. How about one more, Lee?
Yeah, could you speak a little bit more to its intention since that is the foundation of Buddhism? And, you know, when you were talking last week about good intention, that's really what it's all about. But then so many things are done out of good intention, right, that really aren't.
Uh-huh.
And even the inner voices, it's almost like the dad feeding the son out of love.
Yeah.
For your own good.
Yeah.
I feel like what goes on in my head with self-criticism sometimes is the same thing. If I really look underneath, there's a voice that's really scared, that really wants me to be better. And it's a good intention, but it's twisted. It's like love twisted. So I'm not sure how that good intention part, externally and internally, fits with this Buddhist concept.
Yeah, thank you. I think it's complicated because we have many intentions running. You know, I kind of imagine the mind is like a little, I don't know how to put it, it's like a ball that has a dozen bungee cords connected to it that are, and the ball's in a box, as it were, and the bungee cords are various lengths and strengths, and there are different angles in the box. And the sum, the vector sum of all those bungee cords determines the position of the ball, the state of mind in that moment at any time, right? So we have multiple things pulling on us, levels and so forth. You know, how I myself relate to that is I think that first there are certain negative intentions that given the negativity bias are very powerful. Anger is a very powerful negative intention to destroy or smash or aggress upon. You know, it's a very powerful. And I'm very leery of when that gets going. You know, it's a big flag for me as soon as that one gets going. You know. The second thing is that I think, as I'll start segueing momentarily, I'm going to go into the positive intentions toward ourselves. Because so far I've really talked about abstaining from inner speech that is not well-intended, not useful, not true, not timely, you know, and not sweet or at least civil. That's primarily what that's talking about, where we just don't do that. And I think to mobilize why we would be that way, maybe that's a good segue to the next thing I'll get into. At the end of the day, one last thing. I use what I call the friend standard, which is kind of a segue, actually, which I'll get into in a second. In other words, what would I wish for a friend? And then can I wish that for myself? If I would not, it's kind of the inversion of the book Golden Rule. If I would not wish that for you, why would I wish that for myself? And I'm going to think more about what you're raising here, because I can feel there's more to it. So thank you. So now I want to talk about moving more toward the positive frame, not just abstaining from harming ourselves or bringing ill will to ourselves, but bringing a positive stance to ourselves. And a frame for this are the traditional wishes in loving-kindness meditation in Buddhism. So loving-kindness, actually, the word that's used for it in the traditional language of Buddhism, which is Pali, is metta. You've probably heard that word, metta. There's a basketball player for the Lakers who has the word metta as one of his name, the former Ron Artest. I think, what's his name? Metta World Peace, something like, literally, legally he changed it. Okay. That's how they announce it. Meta World's Peace scored a 3-foot. You know. Okay, whatever. That's basketball. Okay, metta. The root of the word metta, interestingly, is friendliness. When we talk about loving kindness, it can sound kind of abstract or lofty or Hallmark-ish card. You know, not that there's anything wrong with a Hallmark card. I've given more than my share. But it has to do with a basic friendliness, which is so human and so real. So we're talking here about a basic friendliness toward ourselves. And again, I think with regard to intention, you know, there's a question really of what's the bottom line? Is there a warm-heartedness in it? Is there a friendliness in it? You know, we can feel it when there is. Okay, so the traditional wishes when we extend friendliness to others are that we wish that others be safe, that they be healthy, that they be happy, and that they live with ease. And these wishes are to be extended traditionally to 5 types of people. Benefactors, those who have given us a lot. Friends, you know, that we have more of a horizontal relationship with, but a lot of warm-heartedness. Could be family members. Then neutral people. Then difficult people. And last and not least, ourselves. So here's my question for you. I'm going to do a little practice with you, and then we'll just kind of talk about it, okay? So if you could, just for a moment, about 30 seconds, and I'll move us along at a pace of about 30 seconds, start with exploring what's it like to wish that you be safe from inner and outer harm. Let's explore that for about half a minute. as you do this, I suggest that you both try to do the practice of wishing that you be safe from inner and outer harm, while also having a little observing of, wow, what would it be like to go through my days on the basis of this friendliness toward myself? How would I think? How would I act? How would I help myself? How would I be an ally to myself? A benefactor, a champion to myself, if my intention was to help myself be safe from inner and outer harm. You know what I'm saying? So both try it and then see what it would be like to be this way. The second one is to may I be healthy. I wish that you be healthy. Includes being vigorous or thriving. And then third, I'd like to wish that you be happy. You can imagine what it would be like to establish the stance in your own mind. A stance for happiness, your personal happiness, happiness broadly defined. How would that be different from your baseline or a bad day? A stance of being for your own happiness. Wish for ease for yourself. Ease often has to do with conditions of, for example, pain or also economic well-being. Having enough food, shelter, comfort, a reasonable schedule, not too much work, not too many burdens. Time for yourself, ease. Wishing for your ease, again, what would it be like to take a stand in your own mind of being for your own ease? Okay. I like that. I was doing it too. Okay. Comments. What did you notice? What shift did you notice? Yeah, please, right there and then you. Oh, that's great. Good for you. And if you get that kind of little signal, like I got a few signals myself, like, aha, pay attention to that one. So yeah, that's great. That's worth paying attention to. Thank you. Great. Yeah. That's great. And when you do register these positive states, when we do, it's really important to take those extra 10 seconds to really lock them in, to anchor them, to feel them, to register them, to savor them. So defeating that negativity bias of the brain, make the brain like Velcro for the positive. Yeah, how? Or you just stay with it. The key is if you literally you just stay with it, you have that positive experience, where you realize, oh, that's what it feels like to love myself. Or that's what it feels like to have a stand of fairness in my own mind about how I'm evaluating myself. That's what that is like. Okay, I'm going to stay with it, stay with it, stay with it. Just that will make it sink in. Neurons that fire together, wire together, in a nutshell. So they have to do that. Make sense? It's very important when we register these lessons, when we get these fruits, weave them in. Weave them into the fabric of the brain and the self. Don't just leave that money lying on the table, you know, or let it flow right. Don't let those lessons flow through your brain like water through a sieve. Help them stick to your wrist. Yeah. Oh yeah, well, great question. So how do you reconcile, having wholesome wishes for things that we may not get, or we may not get fully? Yeah, and I think part of it has to do somewhat with health in different ways of definition. I've known people who felt radiantly healthy as they were dying of cancer, you know, and so it's how you construct that. That would be part one. Part two is we have the intention and we take action based on that intention. We're not just sitting on our hands going, may I have this, may I have that. I work with people sometimes who, for example, they want to get in a relationship again. And I say, well, are you talking to anybody? Are you going out, doing anything? No. You got to take action. Okay, so we take action, but we try to also have a certain understanding that that we're not so attached to the results. We have an equanimity about what could happen, and we recognize there's so many causes that create results. So we put the logs on the fire that we can, you know. Quoting Leonard Cohen, ring the bells that still can ring. Forget your perfect offering. There is a crack in everything. That's how the light gets in. So that's, and that for me is very noble. It's to tend to the causes we can, while being equanimous about the results and realistic. I mean, that's a win-win strategy. We take responsibility for what we can, and we're at peace about the results. A little more.
Let's stop going through this exercise.
Yeah. Yeah. So what Bill's bringing up, I think, is very important, right? Anybody else feel that? Or, like, is any, like, contraction around, you know, being warm-hearted or supportive toward oneself, right? And a little comment on that. It's interesting how we relate to this. In other words, if we relate to a stance, you know, toward our own well-being, that is, that kind of targets the presumed self inside the mind, you know, the inner personality, if you will, you know, the me, then it gets kind of hard, especially if there's any kind of background about don't be vain, don't be selfish, don't be narcissistic, etc. And a funny way out of this for me has been to almost see myself, amongst many others, from a bird's eye view. And then ask myself, is there anything about that guy over there, the one with this jacket, you know, that guy over there, is there anything, you know, uniquely despicable or sick or perverse or degraded or depraved or sinful, what have you, about him, out of all 7 billion humans on the planet, as well as other living beings, that is so awful about him that says the general principles of benevolence and fair play and, you know, morality and goodwill rather than ill will don't apply, right? And when you do that, it gets absurd. And you start realizing, no, no. And then you realize, of all those people, which one, you know, do I know best? It's the guy with the brown jacket, right? And who do I have the most effect on? That poor sucker. I've been pounding on him for 59 years, right? So to me, that takes, that helps. That has helped me to look at that. And to also realize, if he's lame or halt, you know, can he help others? So quote the Buddha, what is it? If one wants to help beings swept along by a swollen river, how well can one do that if one is also swept along? Put your own oxygen mask on first, as they say. Right? So there's, these for me have been things I've done to help me in this area. And curiously and paradoxically, as we mobilize this kind of warm-heartedness for ourselves, we become less and less self-conscious. We become less and less selfish. We become much more easygoing when people poke fun at us. It's definitely been true around my dinner table. You know, I've gotten a lot easier about that. So maybe another comment or two and we'll wrap up. Great. Yeah, perfect, great, thank you. Yeah. Well, how about, since it's 8:30, a bit past, how about we just sit for a minute and we wrap up? I really do encourage you this week to just explore what it, you know, to be aware from time to time, maybe a few times a day, of the tenor of the inner speech. Is it right speech, as it were? In other words, and in particular, is there harshness to it or ill will toward yourself? And also, see what it's like to move through life from a stance of, you know, being for your own fundamental safety and health and happiness and ease. See what that's like. It's easy to think of this as some kind of whooshy California sentimental practice. And it's actually quite rigorous. to bring that. Because what it does very quickly, we haven't really talked about this, I'm going to talk about grasping next week, the nature of grasping, especially in the mind. But what it does, if we really are on our own side, we start paying much closer attention to the Buddha's teaching about how craving creates suffering. Grasping or resistance creates suffering. And we start grasping less and getting reactive less to the contents of our own mind. It takes us right there if we want to live with inner safety, you know, inner ease. Okay? So let's sit for a minute. Thanks for your kindness.